Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 92. Bringing you authors of science fiction and fantasy, publishing industry analysis, writing tips, book reviews, and the occasional belly laugh.
World while you were gone.
Nice segue there, Sean.
It's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Oh yeah, we're brilliant.
Yeah, if you need a really, really tall blonde person, I'm your woman.
This is Lou Anders, editorial director of Pyre Books.
This is Tracy Hickman.
This is Sean Williams.
And now, your hosts. Hello, publishing fans. Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. I'm your host, Sean Farrell. Just as a disclaimer, if you hear noise in the background, that's someone outside working on his motorcycle. I have to record this now or it's never going to get done, and this is one of the many joys of living in an apartment complexes. But anyway, welcome to the show. The final show before Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing 2.0 comes your way in August. Today we are joined by James Gund, a true legend in the field of science fiction and fantasy. And this is really an interview not to be missed, a wonderful interview, and I'm thrilled to have Professor Gund on the show. Well, in just 12 days, I am leaving for Comic-Con International, and I will be conducting several interviews while I'm there, as many as I can squeeze in. And in this episode, I want to tell you finally exactly how this podcast is going to be growing and is going to be changing. So before we get to the interview, I am pleased to announce that Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing now has a staff of volunteers who will be contributing regularly to the podcast and to the website. And that is really what 2.0 is all about. Being consistent. Being a website that you just don't come to subscribe to a podcast feed and get a new show every once in a while, but that you come to every week because you know there's always going to be something new. You know that if there's big news, it's going to be there. Book reviews, you'll find them there. If you need something to read, we want to be the first folks you think about when you need a recommendation. So, I would like to introduce these folks. I'm very excited to have them on board. Okay, so here we go. First up is Brent Bowen. And Brent turned onto reading at an early age, the product of Bible stories given as punishment for stealing candy from a drugstore. That's awful. Brent devours books of all genres, and although Samson and Delilah is one of his favorites, he would prefer to blend mysticism with archaeologist canines and plasma armor. That's what I'm talking about. Since then, Brent's first paid published story was a tweet, and per word, it was a pretty good gig. And he studied with Elizabeth Baer, Deborah Doyle, Stephen Gould, James McDonald, Laura J. Mixon, Patrick and Teresa Nielsen Hayden, and John Scalzi at the 2009 Viable Paradise 13 Writers Workshop. Awesome, I wish I was there. Brent lives in a Kansas City suburb with his wife, two children, Mutt Monty, and pretty golden retriever Rufus. Poor Monty, he's not getting any love here, Brent. Learn more about Brent and his work at splitlegend.com/news. And Brent is going to be our first regular correspondent on the show. He'll be conducting interviews, and they're going to be mostly on location. He's going to be at the Campbell Awards, the World Fantasy Convention, and ArmadilloCon. So, in fact, today's interview with James Gund is Brent's first interview for the podcast. So, he's doing a really great job. I've already have two interviews from him that he's done, and he's good. So you guys and gals are really going to enjoy what he brings to the podcast. And also, Brent wanted me to link to a recent article he found about Professor Gund, and I will post that in the show notes. He highly recommends it. So please, come to the show notes and check that story out. All right. Stephen Klotz. And Stephen, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly. Returns. Stephen has been with us for, about a year, I guess, now, as a book reviewer. He is an aspiring speculative fiction writer with a physics degree, working as a web developer for an international art company. He lives in Los Angeles with his linguist wife and two cats. He reviews the books he reads at mentatjack.com. I think we have a Dune fan here. And Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, primarily so he doesn't forget why he liked them. His current project is Tag Shadow. And you can find this. This is really cool. You should definitely go check this out. And we'll link to it on the website, tagshadow.com. And it's an ambitious, multi-dimensional map of science fiction and fantasy literature. What's really cool about it, what I love about the Tag Shadow, is you can find a book or an author on there that you like, that you know you like because you've already read the book, say, and it will give you a recommendation of what to check out. And it just has the cover art there, and you can click on the cover art and get more information. I find it much more useful than, say, the recommendations of Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com or anything like that. So check that out, tagshadow.com. Moses Sirigar III, his first truly spiritual experience came from watching the 85-episode-long Robotech saga at the age of 10. And I understand, because I watched all the He-Man episodes when I was 5 or 6. I think that counts. That's the same ballpark. He decided that he wanted to give back someday and try to inspire others, just as the series did for him. After high school, he spent 16 years searching for the meaning of life, decided it was simple enough, and returned to his first love, dreaming up epic stories and being an epic goofball. Moses is preparing to unleash his debut fantasy novel on the willing, hopefully not the unwilling, is that it, Moses? It's titled Deus Ex Karma, The Black God's War, and it's an homage to Homer's Iliad, but don't let that scare you. He also blogs about the writing life, and he looks forward to watching Robotech DVDs with his 3-year-old son, Athens, someday soon. Which I understand also, as I look forward to watching Masters of the Universe DVDs, and I have them all with my son, hopefully in the next year or so. If I can get him to watch anything but Thomas, oh my goodness. Anyway, moving on. Matt Hughes, a freelance writer and a full-time technology lead at a private college, Matt Hughes holds a BA in English with writing emphasis and African studies from Luther College. Matt writes a blend of science fiction and fantasy and is an alumni of Viable Paradise 13 along with Brent. Is Viable Paradise taking over the show? He's currently at work on a sci-fi thriller. He also writes a variety of nonfiction articles on technology, food and fitness, and health, among other topics. When he's not at the keyboard, Matt spends his time running, gardening, or practicing martial arts. He lives in Northeast Iowa with his wife, a dog, and a cat. And he keeps a blog at asymonte.com. Links on the website, of course. And finally, Brenda Cuthern. And Brenda, I'm probably pronouncing your last name incorrectly too. Here's a challenge. I've never actually met these folks, so they responded to the call to action I put out a couple months ago. But Brenda joins us as a reviewer as well. And I swear Brenda sent me a bio, and I can't find it anywhere at the time of this recording. And I haven't been able to get another one from her yet. So Brenda, I am sorry. I will give you a proper and special introduction in the next show. But Brenda is with us as well. She already sent in her first book review. Good stuff. And I'm very pleased to have her join the team. So there's the team. Brent, Moses, Matt, Brenda, and Steven. I'm very excited to be working with these folks. And we're going to be working, each contributing a little bit, which adds up to a lot every month. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's the crew. Come by the website and welcome them. Make sure to view their information on the About Us page. And that's it. That's what 2.0 is all about. There's going to be some other little changes you will hear, mostly hear and see. I hope to have a new website. It'd be nice to have it by this year. But, you know, the truth is, things like that cost money because I can't do it myself. And even if I had the know-how on how to do that, I don't have the time. So I have to outsource that, but the money from that has to come from the podcast. So I am excited to announce, so we do have some sponsors who will be sponsoring the rest of the year for us. Very, very excited to have these sponsors on the show. So please, as you're listening to future episodes and you hear that they sponsored it, check out their websites. They're all very much venues that fans of this genre and certainly aspiring writers need to know about and need to check out. And I will explain more on that in the future as each of the sponsors has their shows come up. And of course, we are always honored and humbled to accept donations at the website. And that is available as well. Okay, let's get to... Oh, what is this? It's a voicemail.
Hello, my name is Kevin, and I'm a huge fan of adventures in sci-fi publishing. I'm nervous, though. This is the first time I've left feedback anywhere, so I just wanted to say that I'm thrilled to see that you are putting out shows once again. I was afraid for a while that you had pod faded, so it's great to have you back. Go Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. I also wanted to bring something to your attention that I thought you might be interested in, because a while ago you covered the sort of quote-unquote death and rebirth of Realms of Fantasy magazine on your podcast. So recently there was an announcement on Realms of Fantasy's own website that there was an update in the status of the magazine. Apparently they're having trouble. Apparently subscription revenue was not sufficient at the moment to keep the magazine going. And they're worried about its financial situation going into the future. It's not an announcement that the magazine's dead again, but just that they need more people subscribing. I don't know if it was the bad economy or the announcement, the premature announcement itself that the magazine had died a while ago, but I guess fewer people were renewing their subscriptions than they had expected, and it's causing problems. So I renewed my subscription to the magazine right away, but it seemed like that's basically all I can do, since I don't have an awesome podcast and the ability to reach hundreds and thousands of science fiction and fantasy readers, as some people might do. But anyway, that's it. I just wanted to say it's wonderful to have your podcast back. Thanks for all the hard work and all the shows, all the great shows that you're putting out and helping me get through every day at my own cubicle-based career. So that's it. Thanks a lot.
Kevin, don't be nervous, my friend. I will never pod fade. I don't think. Yes, check out rofmag.com. In fact, you can fan their Facebook page. They have a little, the Facebook dialog box or whatever that thing's called on the side of their website. So you can click on that. It goes right to Facebook. And it says there, I notice on the Facebook page, that you can receive a free issue of the August issue, I believe, of the magazine by placing their banner on your website. So if you blog, please do it. And if you like the magazine, subscribe, write a review on the magazine. Help spread the word. They do have a great production, and they deserve our support, as always. And Kevin, thank you very much for the feedback. I really am honored that I am the first podcast, well, I'm not a podcast, that this podcast is the first podcast that you've actually called and left a voicemail for. Very cool. So please call again. Okay, before the interview, I also have an email here, and this is from Emilio, and he writes concerning the recent Tracy Hickman interview. And he says, in part, as an outsider, unpublished, wannabe author, but still engineer, I take issue with the comment that Mr. Hickman made regarding the publisher's role is not to provide books, but rather to provide quality. I would say that is a derivative of the true purpose, to make money. They will not make money unless they provide quality. I don't completely agree with that, but I wish I did. I like that statement. And even then, it's not really quality, is it? Okay, I should have kept reading. I do agree the markets are changing, primarily because there is so much information, entertainment, content clamoring for a limited amount of viewers or readers. That part is new, but I don't think the publishers are idiots and unable to shift the focus or business models. I think they are doomed to begin with, at least here in the U.S., in any population which is highly integrated into the television, movie, internet, entertainment complex. Books are going to be less and less competitive as people are trained to shift their attention to glitz, even glitz with no substance, case in point, Avatar. Yeah, I'm with you on that. It was pretty, but I was ready for that movie to be over, and I have no interest in seeing it again. I hold little hope for electronic readers. They just don't offer the same experience, and for the majority of the population, they never will. I agree with that, Emilio, until the iPad. And even though I don't have an iPad myself, the things I've heard about it makes me want one. But I'm going to wait. I would say the younger generation might be educated on using readers, but the fact remains it is words and nothing but. No music, animation, dancing, shooting, or other live action. Sure, there will always be a market for books. It will just be a smaller market. Few are making a good living on it now, and fewer still in the near future. Plus, the competitive nature of it will, in my opinion, lessen the chance of good authors being groomed from rough stones to shiny jewels. Thank you for the email, Emilio. It's good to hear from you, as always. And, I hope you're wrong in this. I think people, maybe I should say I hope, people are starting to hunger for more substance, for deeper stories once again. you can only get so much glitz, you know? And I find myself going to hardly any movies these days. And, you know, I justify it by saying they're too expensive. And that's true. It's hard to drop, you know, $12 on a movie. I'd rather wait for the DVD. But the truth is, when something comes out that I really want to see, I go see it. There's just not a lot of movies being made that I really want to see because there's not enough substance to them. Other people I talk to, they express similar feelings. So it's just a hunch. But I hope that the pendulum has started swinging back. And as people want more meaningful entertainment, they will once again turn to books. And I do think that what we think of as a book is going to be changing. I'm starting to believe that as the technology is really starting to pick up on how we use different kinds of readers. Okay, let's talk to James Gunn, shall we? And please come back in August for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing 2.0. You know, write a blog post about it. Tell your friends. You know, try to spread the word. It's going to be really cool. And Brent, Moses, Brenda, Stephen, Matt, and I will see you then. So, until August, until 2.0, and until Comic-Con, keep reading.
So, Ghost infected Frank. He passed it on to the other guys, and I got it from his corpse.
Right.
Hello, Echo. How are you feeling?
Did I fall asleep?
For a little while.
Previously on Heroes.
You had to go and be the detective, didn't you, Matt?
I'm not an aggressive person, but...
Ugh, man, there's just way too much on all these channels.
But only in-game.
Everybody lives, Rose. Just this once! In your dreams, Nutloaf!
Bite my shiny metal hat.
Sometimes I get visions.
Walter, what are you doing? Watch and learn, son.
I wish there was some way to find out what's really worth watching.
There is.
What? Who? What was that?
Tuning into Sci-Fi TV is the viewer's guide to genre television.
Where is that coming from?
With its spoiler-free quick reviews and water cooler and the spoiler-filled in-depth back porch discussions, Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV is the only resource fans need to know what's on, what's good, and what's coming soon in science fiction and fantasy television.
How did you get into my house?
Join Kevin, Wendy, and Brent each week for the latest in genre television.
I'm calling the police.
You can find Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV at tuningintosci-fi-tv.com.
No, seriously. How did you get into my house?
My guest today is one Hugo Pilgrim in Eaton Awards. He's the author of numerous novels such as The Immortals, Campus, and The Millennium Blues. Has served as past president of both the Science Fiction Writers of America and the Science Fiction Research Association. He is one of only 25 individuals to ever be bestowed the title of Damon Knight Memorial Grand Master by the SFWA, an honor given to a living author for a lifetime's achievement in science fiction and fantasy. For more than 40 years, he's taught writing of the genre at the University of Kansas, and he's the current director of the Center for the Study of Science Fiction. I'm here today with one of the true legends of science fiction. I'm absolutely delighted to be speaking with James Gunn. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Jim. As a graduate of the university, I may have a hard time not calling you Professor Gunn. That okay?
That's sure.
Okay.
Or call me Jim.
Okay. It was funny when I was doing correspondence with Chris McKittrick back and forth and talking about the Campbell Conference that I kept wanting to call you Professor, and he was like, it's Jim. So it may slip into being Professor Gunn on occasion, but I'll trade Jim. Much of your focus is on education of science fiction writing and reading. Tell us a little bit about the Center for the Study of Science Fiction and what you see as its purpose.
When I became a member of the full-time of the English department in 1970, after having spent a dozen years in public relations, the first thing that happened as I was talking to the chair of the English department then about joining the department was he said the English department had voted unanimously to welcome me into the teaching full-time. And then he added, and some younger members of the department hope you will be willing to teach a course in science fiction. This was an unusual experience for many people who were interested in the teaching of science fiction. They had to fight for courses, but I had one offered to me. And as a matter of fact, throughout my experience of full-time teaching in the department, I was generally offered the opportunity to teach a science fiction course whenever I wished. Most of my responsibilities were teaching fiction writing courses, but almost every year, and sometimes twice a year, I'd teach a course in science fiction of one kind or another. And then about 4 years after I became a full-time teacher, this is in 1974, I realized that one of the things that the country needed was background. There was, when I was president of SFWA back in 1970, 71, or 71, 72, somewhere around there, I kept getting a lot of letters from potential teachers saying, I've been assigned this course to teach in science fiction. What do I teach? And so, you know, one of the things I decided to respond to that was offering a sort of a background course in science fiction in the summer when potential teachers would be able to take it. And in 1974, I offered the first of these, which I called at that time the Intensive English Institute on the Teaching of Science Fiction, a course that I still offer in the summer. And I remember we had nine students come to that first one, and then the second time in 1975, I had happened to get a notice in a major magazine, because Ben Bova was editor there, and he gave me the opportunity to get some promotion. We had a big turnout, and we had one of the scholarship halls for summer. I think we had about 20 people come around, all parts of the country. And at that time, I decided to. well, we were also offering other courses. For instance, there was a team-taught course in futurism, which involved me and brought in Fred Pohl and few and other people from other areas. And there were courses across the university, and we were beginning to develop collections in Spencer Library to support the various things we were doing. And I decided that that what we really needed was something, some organization to bring all these interests together. And I went to through the process of proposing that we establish a Center for the Study of Science Fiction. And it was met with a great, you know, went through very, very well. And a few years later, when my father died, my brother decided that he'd like to honor his memory, and he donated some money to found an endowment for the center. And since then, it's grown gradually, steadily. You know, we've began offering a writer's workshop in science fiction in the summer, which is going on this summer. And the various kinds of activities have been brought together in the center, which has, you know, been modestly supported by the university, but generally by the enthusiasm and work of a great many people.
So it really started, if I'm hearing it correctly, it really started as a means for educators,
right,
to become broaden their understanding of the genre, and it's really evolved since then.
It's evolved. As a matter of fact, it's really started off as sort of a national affair with people coming from all over the country, and then we began getting people from foreign countries, first Canada and Argentina, then the Netherlands and Denmark. Then got people from New Zealand and China and Australia and Japan. And so it's become really an international affair. these days, with opportunities to take courses more common than they were then, we don't get as many people from outside the state. We still get, you know, two or three or four or five people who come here. It was listed in one resource as being the place to come if you really wanted to get a good background in science fiction. We appreciated that. And we'll have maybe three or four people, but mostly the current enrollment is by currently enrolled students.
Okay. Well, you mentioned now the Campbell Conference is Friday, July 16th, and it culminates in several weeks of activities that you mentioned for the center. For those unfamiliar with the Campbell Conference, what can one expect if they attend?
Well, there are lots of conferences and conventions that use science fiction as their focus, and they all operate in different fashions. Most of them, however, are places where people give talks or have panels or discussions that are led by people who are very knowledgeable in the field. That's certainly an opportunity of each one different kind, but each of a different way of approaching the dissemination of information about science fiction, all of which is important to our own goals. But the Campbell Conference is unique in that it is a relatively small group of people, but very knowledgeable people, many writers and an editor or two, sometimes people who are in the business of collecting science fiction, or students, scholars of various kinds. And we all sit around a big table and discuss a single topic for a day. We've had various kinds of topics in the past, the nature of the science fiction novel and its future, publishing problems in the field or the way they're going to be shaped. And this year, because it's the 25th anniversary of the death of a longtime friend of our science fiction programs, Theodore Sturgeon, and the sort of commemorating the completion of his published works. There's four volumes of them there. We're dedicating the Campbell Conference discussion to Theodore Sturgeon and to the science fiction short story in general, because science fiction is a genre that keeps changing. Its subject has changed, and its way of addressing that subject continues to change as well. And all of this is I think, an important aspect of trying to keep up with what's going on in the field. So in honor of Ted, we're also having a series of readings in the Orient Books in Kansas Union, to which anybody can attend. And from all day Saturday, July the 17th, there will be these readings going on, and we usually have a mass autographing session, which also will be held about, I think, 12:45 to 1:45, and also in Orient Books, where the writers who are present will be available to autograph any books that they can bring or buy there. So it's an opportunity for people to participate as much as they wish in this kind of, I think, a very, very exciting opportunity to really participate in something that's really alive and growing and of interest to a great many people.
Well, very, very timely discussion. I thought, watching what all's going on in the industry, which I'm going to get to with this year's Campbell Conference devoted to the science fiction short story and the work of Theodore Sturgeon. I first wanted you to, if you wouldn't mind, I've read some of your remarks on Theodore in the past, but was hoping you might be able to share with our audience a little bit of your fondest memories of him.
Well, Ted was a real unusual person in many ways. He was I once said that the way you can characterize authors is by constructing a sentence that begins, "The world would be wonderful if." In terms of Heinlein, I used to say, Heinlein would say, "The world would be wonderful if the incompetent people would get out of the way and just let the competent people handle the problem." Or in the case of A.E. Van Vogt, for instance, he might say, "The world would be wonderful if only we could discover those powers which are lurk beneath inside of us, anxious to be released." And with Ted, I thought, you know, Ted would say, "The world would be wonderful if only we could love each other." And that was sort of Ted's constant theme, the need for loving people, even though they don't seem very lovable. And he usually dealt with characters who were handicapped in one way or another by mostly psychological but often physical handicaps. So he had a great openness, a great heart for these kinds of issues. And as a consequence, Ted himself was a person who became a sort of an instant confidant. People would talk to him. He would, and a good example of that was, you know, when Ted came here, as he did for about 20 years as a visitor, visiting writer in our intensive teaching of Science Fiction Institute, he'd be here for a week, as was Gordon Dixon for another week, and Fred Pohl for a third week. Ted was usually in the middle, and we had a hospital administrator from Oklahoma City, I think, who came up to participate in the Institute sessions because she heard that Ted was going to be here. And it just happened that she was on an airplane with Ted, and they happened to sit side by side, and she began pouring out her life story to Ted. Ted was a great listener. And she was so fascinated by that. And then, you know, one of his students out in San Diego, named Barbara Odell, you know, came here to participate in the Institute, only because Ted was here, and then persuaded everybody, because he wasn't able to bring his then spouse with him, to participate in raising funds to bring her there as a surprise. And during the whole process, we were, at that time, I was making a series of films featuring science fiction writers and editors talking about various aspects of the genre. And she decided that was such a good idea that she organized her own filming of Ted in a similar way. She got me an interview, to organized everything, including the film. She was a film major. And so she did this half-hour film as her project for the Institute. So those were two of the... And another thing about Ted, I don't think throughout the whole period he was here, Ted ever quite understood that this was for teachers. He always thought he was addressing writers, and he would always talk about various aspects of writing to them, which they enjoyed. I mean, it was probably, you know, just as well it went that way. But one of the things he used to bring with him was a book that he'd found in a used bookstore, which dealt with style, and it told the same ridiculous story of about, you know, a page and a half story in 175 different styles, all the way from bombastic to lyrical and so forth. And he found that, you know, very fascinating. And the third anecdote that always I enjoyed was that he had this theory that he liked to propound, that whenever his stories reached a point of emotional intensity, he liked to revert into what he called metric prose. That is, he would adopt a meter, iambic, for instance, or one of the other kind of poetic meters, and write the passage in that meter. And he always said, although he didn't think that the reader noticed it consciously, he thought that subconsciously they responded to this. And he well may have been right, but he also said that his wife then, Jane, he told her about it, and she wrote her whole story in a single meter. He thought that was perhaps going too far.
That's a little bit of overkill.
Yeah.
Well, you had mentioned Theodore Sturgeon's capacity for love, and one of the things when I'd referenced the timing of the discussion around the dedication of the Campbell Conference to the short story was how does it make you feel, or how do you believe it would make him feel to hear others talk about the short story potentially being a lost art form?
A lost art form? I don't think it's a lost art form. I think it has diminished its importance some, but it's still a very meaningful and essential part of science fiction. One of the things I think about science fiction is that because it works at a very high level of both intellectual and emotional intensity, it's very hard to sustain at the novel length. It can be done, but it's much more difficult. And science fiction, I've always thought, was at its best in the novel at length, because it allows the writer to establish a milieu and a world in which things happen, and to develop certain challenging concepts, but because of its length, it doesn't demand that you solve them. Indeed, most of the novelettes develop an idea and dramatize it and get out of it in an effective way, but it, unlike the novel, it doesn't really require by its length that you come up with any solutions. And so, in that respect, there are, hundreds of great science fiction short stories, maybe thousands. And that's why for many years the science fiction anthology was one of the best methods to approach science fiction, because you got a lot of things in an anthology, a lot of ideas, a lot of concepts, a lot of styles, a lot of great fiction. Whereas there are certainly some great science fiction novels, but not nearly to compare with the effectiveness of the short story.
In terms of quality.
Just in terms of greatness, the things that you really respond to. And that's why when I originally taught the science fiction, I almost always dealt with the short fiction.
Okay.
I do have a novel section that I'm teaching this summer. I alternate that with the short stories because there is a need to understand the novel and be introduced to it. But nevertheless, my heart really lies with the short fiction. And that's, Ted represents that, because he was a great, really perhaps the greatest short science fiction writer in the experience of the field, in terms of both his craft and skills, but also his feeling for it. And it was very difficult to escalate up to the novel length. He did write some novels, and some of them, particularly like More Than Human, are really great works. But even More Than Human is composed of three long short stories. And the short story, which used to dominate the field because there were, all these great magazines. Today the magazines are in trouble, and it's really hard to see them dominating the field the way they did. One of the problems with science fiction today is that the novel, though there are thousands of them, something over 2,000 novels published or reprinted every year, it's very hard for them to shape the field the way an editor like John Campbell, for instance, was able to shape the field, or Horace Gold, or Tony Boucher, or Michael Moorcock, or these editors who have really, you know, controlled the way science fiction was perceived and developed. So it's very difficult today for any one novel, or even though cyberpunk had its day and achieved some significant success, it didn't really reshape the field.
Yeah, Eric T. Reynolds and I have discussed on a number of occasions, he's going to continue to publish short fiction regardless of whether it's financially successful, because he just believes it's that important for the field to be able to generate the discussion that the short fiction can generate that the novel length works can't. Now he's also admitted to me that he's introducing novels into his lineup because they're more financially viable and that.
Well, that's good. Chris McKittrick, Aaron mentioned, his first novel is just being published by Eric, so it's a great occasion for them both.
Yes, certainly. Well, it was interesting, you've talked about how science fiction can shape the world, I think both in your remarks and then your memories of Theodore Sturgeon. And I know you hold this belief that science fiction can help us better engage with the world we live in. How do the Campbell and Sturgeon Award nominees that are up this year reflect that notion?
Well, certainly they represent what the judges of, that I'm the chair of both the Campbell Award Committee for the Best Science Fiction Novel of the Year and the Sturgeon Award Committee for the Best Short Science Fiction of the Year. And always the issue that has to be dealt with in these awards is, first of all, is it something that is significant in the history or tradition of science fiction, and how does it fulfill that or carry it farther? And secondly, well, how well is it done as a work of art? And these things always have to be balanced off. For a number of years, I felt in the Sturgeon Awards some of the traditional values of science fiction in terms of idea and concept were not as much honored as I thought they ought to be, though people differed. Certainly in the fiction that's being honored this year, I think both of them represent both marvelous writing and concept that really is significant. One of the things I have signed my emails with in recent years is, let's save the world through science fiction. And I like to think that science fiction, because it does deal with ideas that shape the future we're going to have, and with anticipating the problems that we face and maybe how to cope with them, as well as encouraging people to think seriously about issues rather than more primitively through emotional responses, that it does offer the possibility of a world which is still filled with problems, of in some way coping with those problems effectively in ways in which I don't think any other kind of genre does. So maybe it's a hyperbole to think that science fiction might help save the world, but on the other hand, if we do think so, it does encourage us to act upon it. So I hope people will adopt that kind of approach.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the lasting effect that probably not only the winners of the Campbell and the Sturgeon Awards will have, but also some of the nominees. And, you know, before I was accepted into Viable Paradise, I remember browsing the workshop suggested reading list for aspiring fantasists and saying, well, I've got some work to do as an aspiring, you know, science fiction writer, aspiring fantasist. But then as I was doing research for our discussion, I noticed it pales in comparison to you're a basic basic science fiction library.
Mm-hmm.
How do the works find their way on and off the list? And is it a given that the Campbell winners, yeah, that the Campbell winners find their way there?
It's pretty much a given, I think, that that you'll find them there. Although the Basic Science Fiction Library, which really started as a project that Alexei Panshin and a group of committee members from the Science Fiction Writers of America adopted to try to come up with a canon.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a process of soliciting opinions from a lot of people. And they came up with this basic list, which was published in the Library Journal. A little bit later, I thought, well, we really need to update this. So I took their list and began to amplify it and annotate it. Mm-hmm. So there would be some kind of way of which people could judge whether or not these works were worth reading. And gradually, over the years, it's grown. But in fact, a number of years after that Library Journal article appeared, I published it again, my list, in the Library Journal. So it probably needs to be published somewhere again, although it's available on our Center for Study of Science Fiction mm-hmm. website. And it really is sort of Chris McKitterick's job now to try to solicit from people that have been alumni of our group or members of various people we're associated with to suggest additions that ought to be made to it. And I think it probably needs to be still updated again. Science fiction is growing. It started as a group of about 25 titles. And by the time I got finished, it was about 100. It probably is, I don't know what it is now, 200 maybe. But they're all solid works, which people, I think, if they're interested in the field, can well use as a reference. And if they read the way all the way through it, they will be very knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting when you were talking about Theodore Sturgeon and his, when you came to have him speak to educators, and a lot of times he was believing he was speaking to aspiring writer community. I'll shift gears a little bit and say, what advice do you have on that notion of aspiring science fiction writers or fantasy writers? What advice do you generally give them?
Well, first of all, you have to know the field. You have to know what's been done. You have to read well, study it, analyze it, because it's when you're in a field, it's sort of like what Hemingway had to say about the novel. He said writing a novel is getting into the ring with Mr. Tolstoy, and writing a science fiction story is getting into the ring with Heinlein and Asimov and Sturgeon and Van Vogt and many of the contemporary writers. So you have to know both what's been done and what's going on now in order to build a foundation on which you can come up with your own ideas. Secondly, you have to write a great deal, and you have to write it and show it to other people. We offer a writer's workshop as a way of getting feedback on what you're doing, because one thing a writer always has problem with is judging how their own writing is read by other people. And it's very hard to find somebody or a group of people that are willing to be both knowledgeable and honest in providing that kind of feedback. And then the third thing you have to do is to send it off somewhere to be published. You can't be private, because once you begin to send things off somewhere, you realize that the only thing that counts is what's on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody off there in New York, for instance, reading it, has to judge its value only through the word. So you begin to adopt a different kind of attitude to what you're doing. And then finally, I think the fourth thing that the writer needs to do is to evolve a strategy, knowing that the editor wants to say no fast. That's the editor's strategy in order to get through his work and enable him to not only do an effective job of doing his job as an editor, but also have a little time for himself. So knowing that, the author's strategy has to be don't give the editor an excuse to say no. Everything has to be done with the understanding that this has to lead the editor through the story to a satisfactory conclusion. And the moment you make a mistake, you don't know what you're doing, you allow extraneous things to enter the story, you don't emphasize the things you need to emphasize, you don't keep it interesting, you don't make it a desirable thing for the editor to read on, then you've lost as an author, because it's necessary in order to get published for somebody to both read through it and to like it. And work at it.
You mentioned the writer's workshops here, and they're going on, I think, as we speak. But for those, because we do have a large number of the listeners are aspiring writers, what's that application process like, and when would they need to have their materials ready? Because it's always a good idea to start planning next year.
Sure. You're right. We operate on the basis of that writers need to have stories written. We don't ask writers to write while they're here, because they do it in 2 weeks very intensively. So they have to have stories, at least three stories written that they really want to have critiqued. And we admit people to the process by asking them to send me or Chris a story that we can say by reading it that the workshop will be a good experience for them. If they're at not a satisfactory level, we're really looking for people who can benefit by this process, who are, either they just need a little help to get published, to be publishable. They're two different questions. Sometimes you can be publishable and not find the right place to get published, but we want to help them find that through this critiquing process and telling them what they need to do. Or those people who've been published but aren't being published as regularly as they think. So we're looking for people who are already submitting stories and have some reason to think that they're capable of writing publishable fiction. We'll try to help them accomplish that. So submit a story and we'll give you a feedback, and whether, one of the things we offer is we'll critique a story, tell you what we think of it and whether or not you'd benefit by the workshop, whether it'd be a good experience for it. And then, you submit your three stories and we critique those. Everybody critiques them, all the writers critique them, and we critique them, get a lot of feedback. And it's also, I think, a very exciting kind of two-week period, in that you're able to think for 2 weeks only about writing and are in the midst of other writers who are engaged in some same thing. So it's I think it's an unusual opportunity in the life of a writer, where he's not distracted by life going on. Instead, he can really just focus on the one thing that for that time matters to him. And that means you can carry that over often into the rest of your life. And we have had some success in start people getting through the workshop and publishing stories. Last year, a writer named Casey Ball revised the story she submitted and it got published in Analog.
Excellent.
Just in July. And previously, another writer last year just sold a story, and from a few years ago, Kids Johnson won a World Fantasy Award for the story she'd written during the workshop. So, you know, we can't promise that, but it is the lure we hold out, possibility.
That extra little nudge to help shape those writers and get them publishable or ready to be publishable. And I can appreciate the dedicated time, being the father of two and a full-time professional.
Yeah, well, it takes time. You know, one of the things about writing is that you have to do it regularly. You can't do it only once in a while or when you feel like it. If you write a page a day, even, it begins to accumulate. And Fred Pohl used to say that he wrote, his process of writing was write 4 pages a day, whatever he's doing, wherever he was. He wrote his 4 pages, and then he felt good about himself. And when Anthony Burgess spoke here, he said much the same thing. He said he'd learned only one thing about writing, and that's all he had to know. That was that he could write 1,000 words a day. If you write 1,000 words a day, which is about 4 pages, he said, you know, you can write a novel in a couple of months.
Excellent place to be, yes. The other thing around the publishing industry is as I was looking at your career, you have a mantra called sell it twice, which reminds me of writing advice for graduates of Yaug's Law, which is money flowing to the writer. Give us a little background on your thought process and the learning experience that made this a staple for you.
Well, when I was the second time I was writing full time, I got a contract to write a couple of novels. I wrote This Fortress World, which incidentally just got a good review in Asimov's after 60 years, and I collaborated with Jack Williamson on a novel called Starbridge, which also has gotten some good notices. But at that time, I got a $500 advance for each of them, and the second one I had to share with Jack Williamson. And it didn't make any money after that. So it turned out that I had, even though I wrote both of them in 3 months each, I had spent 6 months and made a total of $750. So I decided that was not a way which I could sustain a freelance career. So I decided after that I would break up my story ideas into shorter lengths and sell those to the magazines and then bring them together as a book. And I've done a whole lot of novels that way. And so it also provides a basis, I think, for the notion that when you write something, you want to be sure it's fully used. And it isn't always, you know, used up by your first use of it. You can also use it in other ways. And you can, when you write, you know, I've written a lot of articles about science fiction, and then I brought them together into a book called Inside Science Fiction or other areas that I've dealt with. You can always find additional uses for things. So I think it's both a useful way to make the most of your writing time, but it also is a way to judge what's worth writing on. If you can't think of a way to use it at least twice, it probably isn't worth spending your time on in the first place. And one of the ways a writer makes the best use of his writing time is to devote it to those things which are most closest to his heart, most emotionally involved with, and also have the greatest potential.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome. Anybody who's interested, incidentally, in attending the Campbell Conference, there's a they can look at the Center for the Study of Science Fiction website, and there is a application form that they can check on the details.
Well, that's the question I was going to ask, is where can people find out more about you, your work, and the center?
I have some posted, not only a biography there, and information about the Campbell Awards and the Sturgeon Awards and the list of winners and a lot of information that Chris McKittrick has put up, including some of my essays about science fiction, and a great deal of information. We also have another website that they might find handy to use, called About SF, which is an attempt to organize volunteer activities for the promotion and development of science fiction, particularly science fiction teaching, reading. So these two ways, I think, are ways that they can get involved in science fiction, well as in both in learning about it as well as contributing to it if they have a desire, an ability to do so.
Excellent. Anything else you'd like to mention to our listeners that I may have missed?
Just get involved. Get involved. Read it. Write it if you can. Teach it if you can. Contribute books to children. Make certain that people have the opportunity to enjoy as much as possible this kind of apprenticeship toward the future.
Professor Gunn, I'm really looking forward to this year's conference, and I truly appreciate you spending time with me today.
Well, thank you. It's been a good experience.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit our website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com for online interviews, book reviews, news stories, coverage of live events, videos, and much more. You can send us an email at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com and give us a call at 206-350-5029. Music by Cargo Cult from their track Dirt, available at magnatune.com.